session number 27344, reel 13.
Robert McCandless, reel 13.
God, I've forgotten what I was saying.
You were just saying about there were Corsairs on the aircraft?
Oh, yes. We had Corsairs as our fighters when we were in the Pacific, but they were part of the lease-lend agreement between the US government and the UK government. And the US government, due to pressure from their unions, was insisting that all American equipment had to be ditched. And we were ditching aircraft from the aircraft carrier. And this was Hellcats and Corsairs and all sorts of American aircraft, and the equipment, spares, tools, everything had to be ditched. And we thought this was an absolutely terrible waste. But I suppose the unions felt if all that equipment was going to come back to the States, there was going to be a shortage of work for them. And they insisted on it. So the Corsairs left us. And when we were in Karakaranda, we picked up a squadron of Seafires. And they came with us to South Africa. And I don't know what they were doing, but one of the Seafires had flown from Cape Town to Port Elizabeth. And when he got there, he was unserviceable. So we had to send a couple of maintenance ratings to get it flying. And I was volunteered to fly them, fly the ratings from Cape Town to Port Elizabeth, and then wait with them while they repaired the aircraft, and then fly them back after the Seafire. So we did this, and on the way back from Port Elizabeth, we were flying along the coast, just looking at everyone swimming and all the rest of it going on. And we came to a small town called Wilderness. And when we looked down, there was a grass airfield there, and there was the Spitfire, or the Seafire, in the middle of this grass airfield. So we had no radio contact, but we just went in and landed. And he had gone unserviceable again while he was flying back, and took advantage of the fact there was an airfield there and landed. So the ratings had to start working on this aircraft again. And the Seafire pilot and I went down the beach for a swim. But of course we didn't have any swimming gear with us, and we were in the nutty. And the waves were really quite strong. And we found that when we when we swam out 30 or 40 yards, we could lie across these waves and be carried in as if we were on a surfboard. And this was great. We were thoroughly enjoying this. And then there was a family came along to watch us doing our surfing. So we kept falling off the waves before we reached the beach. In the end, they got fed up and walked off, so we were able to come out. But it really was absolutely delightful there. We had to stay overnight because they hadn't got the aircraft serviceable. And in the hotel there, the rooms were all separate huts round the grounds of the hotel. And these were little round huts with thatched roofs, which they called rondavels. And they were just built like the native huts, and they were very comfortable. So we had a comfortable night there and breakfast, and then they got the aircraft serviceable, so we took off and flew back to Wingfield. But that was a very, very pleasant little jaunt. Anyway, when it came to us to leave Wingfield, there were many tears on the jetty, I must say. We had had a marvellous time there. Incidentally, part of it, South Africans were very, very generous to us. And there were invitations for people to go on holiday, both to Durban and to Johannesburg. And a group of us volunteered to take up these invitations. And we went to Johannesburg. And there was two of us together. And when we got there, we were met at the station by a gentleman, very, very pleasant man. He was the managing director of Dorm and Long South Africa Limited, which is the biggest steel company in South Africa. And he took us back to his home. And he said, "Now, I don't want you to pay for anything while you're here. You just enjoy yourselves and put it on my account wherever you are." And he arranged for us to be shown around Johannesburg and Pretoria for, I think it was a fortnight we were there. And we had the most marvellous time. And he had two delightful daughters that escorted us around the various nightclubs in the evenings. And we had really a most wonderful fortnight holiday. Absolutely marvellous. I don't think we appreciated it as much at the time as I do looking back on it. But it was interesting, actually. We went on what's called the Blue Train from Cape Town to Johannesburg and back again. And that's an overnight journey. And it's rather like the American trains. They're not very fast. And going across the Karoo Desert, you really had a chance to watch what was going on all around you. And although it was a desert, there was a surprising amount of wildlife out there to watch. Anyway, back to Johannesburg, to Cape Town, and the ship was finished its refit. And we joined it, went back to Ceylon again. And I think the Colossus was going to go out to the Far East to continue doing whatever it was doing out there. But we were all put ashore. And we stayed in Karikaranda until we had passages booked on ships back to the UK. And I was on the SS Alcantara, I think it was called. And that was a very pleasant journey back. Again, there was a large number. We went into Karachi and picked up a large number of Indian Army families that were going back home. I mean, these were British families who were the officers had been with the Indian Army, and they were all going back home as well. So it was quite a jolly trip on the way back. And then back in to Leon Solent. Got demobbed and picked up a blue suit. God, they were terrible. And back home.
Had you thought of staying on at all?
Sort of. But I thought at that time the Navy was offering 4-year short-term commissions. And I thought, well, if I take on this 4-year commission and they don't keep me on permanently, I'll simply be 4 years behind my contemporaries in finding jobs and careers. All the time that I'd been in the service, the brewery where I'd been working had been paying me a small retainer. So I felt morally bound to go back to the brewery, which I did. And then I went to Harriet Watt College, Edinburgh, to study brewing. And during that time, I was travelling by motorbike from home, which was Alloa, 30 miles from Edinburgh, and I would travel by motorbike up to the Harriet Watt College. And most of the time it was fine, except the winter of 1947 was a real beast. It really, really was cold for a long time. And I had one little incident in my motorbike when the front wheel caught in the tram tracks, and I finished up sprawled in front of a tram. But luckily he wasn't going very fast either. But at that time the Navy started flying the Volunteer Reserve squadrons, and the Scottish one was based at Abbotsinch near Glasgow. Abbotsinch is now Glasgow Airport. So I was still keen on flying, and I went along and volunteered, and gradually we found that in the brewing course that I was on, there were 11 of us on the brewing course and 5 were ex-Fleet Air Arm. We all joined the RMVR squadron together, and we were having a high old time there.
That seems like quite a high proportion of it.
Oh, well, we were all interested in beer, I suppose. Yes, it was a very high proportion. But anyway, we were flying Harvard's Fireflies and Seafires at Abbotsinch. And we would go there every weekend that we could. And the Navy paid us for our time there, the same as they do the Territorial Army. And they paid us enough to pay our wine bills, which was good. But that was about the sum total of it.
Had you flown the Seafire or the Firefly prior to going?
No, but the Firefly was a really easy aircraft to fly. Gem. The Seafire was very much lighter, and with a, I think it was either 14 or 16 foot nose in front of you, and quite a steep angle because it had a tail wheel. You couldn't see anything in front of you very much, so you had to swing the nose from side to side while you were taxiing to see where you were going. And then when you got lined up on the runway, you couldn't see the runway at all because it was hidden under the nose. And thank you, Manav. The runway at Abbotsinch was the same Sommerfeld tracking as the runway had been at Karakoranda, with the same problems. So that you had to be very careful in taking off in the Seafire, that you didn't put your propeller into the wave of metal ahead of you. But Abbotsinch was built on boggy land, and the runway used to disappear into the bog with great regularity. So there were often times when there was a break in flying while they replaced the runway. But Abbotsinch was good fun. But I must say it distracted us from our course on brewing.
How was it organised? You said you spend the weekend flying, but how would that be organised, your weekend?
Well, there was an RN officer who was really in charge of the squadron, usually a lieutenant, and there was an RNVR, so a volunteer officer, who was CO. He was a lieutenant commander. Then a number of us who were lieutenants, and one or two who were sub-lieutenants. And then a lot of the maintenance ratings were also volunteers, and they would come in at the weekend, and they would have the same sort of privileges. They'd be paid for their time there, and then they could spend their time in a canteen with the other RN ratings. But we go in there on a Friday night or Saturday morning and find out who else was there, and the RN officer would give us exercises to do, and we would arrange who would do them and go and do them. And it was like a flying club, really. And we used to just fly around, getting used to using the Firefly as an anti-submarine aircraft and in ground attack. But it was a nice aircraft to fly.
Was there any differences from the Barracuda?
Oh, yes, tremendous. It was a low-wing monoplane, and the motor, the engine it had was a good, powerful one for the size and weight of aircraft, so it was quite reasonably fast. But one of the things it did have, which was vastly different, we had a radar dome under the aircraft. And in the observer's cockpit, there was a video screen. And in the pilot's cockpit, there was a video screen. And the video screen was probably about 6 inches diameter, in orange in colour. And you couldn't just look at it, because if it was daylight, you couldn't see what was on the screen because of the daylight. There just wasn't sufficient contrast. So they had to have a black tube which fitted over your eyes and down onto this video screen. Now, that would be, I suppose, about 18 inches long, so you weren't bending forward too far to look into it. So you could put that on, and once it was on, you could actually see what was on the screen. But there was also a Perspex panel in the side, so you could look out the side and see your flying instruments. And we were bogging around the Highlands and Islands, trying to get used to flying with your head in this tube and understanding what you were seeing on the video and understanding what was going on in the flying panel at the same time. And it really was so dangerous that in the end we decided that if the observer wasn't going to be able to pick it up, we just weren't going to see it. Oh dear, what a caper that was. I don't know who thought it up. But obviously they weren't regular pilots and they obviously hadn't tried to do it.
And with the Firefly, was there just yourself and the observer?
One observer, yes. There was no air gunner. And it was not a bad aircraft, but not a good fighter aircraft. But it was great for ground attack. It could carry a reasonable number of bombs and it had four 30mm cannons. And it could really hit quite a devastating blow. And in fact, it was used ultimately in Korea to quite good effect. Anyway, we flew those around and we did fly the Seafires around. I quite enjoyed flying the Seafire, except that I got slightly claustrophobic. The cockpit was quite tight in the first place, and the hood, they had tried to keep it slim to avoid too much drag in the aircraft, and the hood was fairly close to the side of your head, and I found that when I turned to look out, my goggles kept striking the perspex of the hood, and I thought that was just a bit too close. But apart from that, I enjoyed flying it. It was good fun. And of course, it was a marvellous aircraft for aerobatics. Really was terrific. So I flew that at Abbots Inch for nearly 3 years, 1948 to 1951. And I don't know, he did quite a lot of flying in that time. And we took the Fireflies to the deck just to get us deck landing training again. And the whole of the squadron did a required number of deck landings in Fireflies without any accidents or incidents at all. And considering that none of us had done deck landings for 4 or 5 years, that was quite good. So we were quite pleased with ourselves.
Were all your fellows in the reserve, were they all really from the kind of Barracuda class of aircraft, or had some of them flown fighter aircraft?
No, many of them had flown fighters. Many of them had flown American Avengers. Some of them had flown Corsairs. Some of them had flown Seafires. So it was a mixed batch altogether. But we just got on together and enjoyed what we were doing. But it was a matter of practicing fighter work in the aircraft and using the Fireflies as make-believe bombers. I remember one occasion we went down to Durham or somewhere down in the northeast of England, and the Fireflies were acting as a bomber force coming in low level over the North Sea, and the RAF, Auxiliary Air Force, the same as we were, but in the RAF, they were going to intercept us. So we were doing our best to dodge them, and they were determined to catch us. And generally they did, because the radar on the east coast of England was very good. But I managed to dodge them once by going low level up the Tyne. But that was bloody dangerous, thinking back on it. Because once I got past the bridges, I got right down on the water, and then discovered I was flying under the high tension wires. That's why they missed me. But oh dear, we used to do some daft things. And again, we used to drink far too much. I mean, Saturday nights were always riotous, they really were. And then we'd have a hangover on the Sunday. But the one thing that I insisted on was that the hangover wasn't allowed to interfere with whatever training we were doing. But anyway, it was good fun and we thoroughly enjoyed it. And then my bosses moved me from Abbots Inch, from a brewery in Alloa to a brewery in Malta. And I went as a brewer in Calder's in Malta, and I was there for 6 months brewing night shift all the time. And that was fine. I enjoyed Malta because I could swim during the day and go and do my brewing at night. And during that summer, the squadron from Abbots Inch flew out to Malta for their annual training. They were going to do a week's annual training in Malta. So naturally, when they came out, I welcomed them with open arms, and I got permission to fly with them again. So I used to fly with them in the morning, show them around Malta in the afternoon, and then go brewing night shift. So I got a bit short of sleep. To the extent that on the Friday night, when the wardroom mess at Halfar in Malta were dining the RNVR squadron to wish them well on their way back the next day, I was invited to leave the mess before the soup course because I was so noisy. Anyway, it was good fun. I came back from Malta when the Maltese man was sufficiently trained to carry on doing the work that I was sort of standing in for. And this time I was sent to work in Liverpool. And there was a brewery in Scotland Road in Liverpool. Pretty tough area. And I was living in Mount Pleasant, and I used to cycle between Mount Pleasant and the brewery because I used to start work at 4:30 in the morning. And it was amazing going there. Whatever time I cycled, there was always activity going on all around the place. It really was amazing what nightlife there was. And I don't mean necessarily nightclubs. I mean just activity of all kinds. And I remember once standing in the brewery, looking out of the window down into the road, and there was a milk cart going along the road, horse and cart going along, and he was delivering milk and whatever else he had on the cart. And the poor chap was robbed blind because there was a group of kids ran out behind him and jumped on the milk cart, and two were passing stuff off to the ones behind him. Of course, I couldn't draw his attention to it. And I don't know how long, but it must have been 3 or 4 minutes before he realised that all this was going on behind him. So he had to chase them off. And on another occasion, looking out, there was a group of kids got round a car which had been parked in the street. And there must have been 8 or 10 of them. And they pushed this car off into a side street. So I don't know what the driver did when he came back. No idea. Terrible business. But anyway, while I was working in the brewery in Liverpool, I joined the Volunteer Reserve Squadron flying from Stretton near Warrington. So I used to drive out from Liverpool to Stretton each weekend in the same way as I had before. But the nights weren't quite so riotous at Stretton as they had been at Abbots Inch, but still enjoyed it. And the aircraft we were flying there were Sea Furies. They were radial engine, single engine fighters, monoplane fighters. And I think it's the nicest aircraft the Fleet Arm ever had. It really, really was a delight to fly. Very rugged, not too difficult to deck land. Wee bit, I'll tell you about that. But it was a delight to fly, and I was thoroughly enjoying flying with the RN instructor. And he taught me to do formation aerobatics in the Sea Furies, and it was great. I found that really exciting. I enjoyed that immensely. Anyway, in the brewery, I was being paid, I think it was £600 a year, and this was 1951. And it was adequate, I suppose, but only just. And there was a director came from Burton-on-Trent to inspect the brewery. And in my interview with him, he was chatting to me, and I said I didn't think we were paid sufficiently for our responsibilities. And he sounded very non-committal. And I was rash enough to say to him, either I get a rise or I leave. So there you are, I learned that lesson very quickly. But at the time, actually, the Korean conflict had started, and I knew the Fleet Air Arm was desperately short of aircrew, so I had been considering volunteering anyway. So when I didn't get the rise, I left Brewing and rejoined the service. So it was December 51, I went down to Culdrose, down in Cornwall, right down near Land's End, to do a refresher flying before I would join a squadron to go to Korea. And
was it very specific that you would be joining to go to Korea?
Oh, yes. That was the purpose of my volunteering. And there were a number of us, I suppose five or six VRs there at the same time. And we were all doing refresher flying in the Sea Furies. And that was good fun. My particular chum while we were there was an Australian. And he was a real rough diamond. But he and I got on like a house on fire. We were there at the time of the Christmas ball. And it's really quite a sweep-up do in the wardroom. And this Australian and I were sitting in the bar, and we decided that we liked to drink black velvet, which is a mixture of champagne and Guinness. And we were eating oysters. And we were enjoying this immensely. So after a while, I said to him, well, I think I'll go and see if there's anyone I can have a dance with. And when I went into the dance hall part of the wardroom, the band had gone and everyone else had gone. So that was the end of that. So I looked around and thought, oh dear, if the dance is over, I think I better help them clear up a bit. So I cleared up. Before I went to bed, I suppose I spent half an hour or a bit more clearing up. Swept everything up into a pile in the middle of the wardroom and left it. And when I wakened up the next day, I realised I'd taken down all the Christmas decorations and it wasn't yet Christmas. So I again realised I was not going to be popular. So I didn't go into breakfast. I got myself dressed to go on leave and drove off. Oh dear, I really was unpopular there. Ha ha ha.